Hi, I'm David Crow, and this is The Infectious Myth. Thank you for being a listener. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like the show at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at Infectious Myth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. My offer of free photographic bookmarks still stands, one for writing to me, one for providing a useful comment that doesn't have to be positive, one for liking facebook.com, and one for following us on Twitter. So if you're a big fan, you can get quite a few. Today we go back to the subject of Ebola with David Rasnick, a molecular biologist who has expertise in AIDS, arthritis, cancer, protease inhibitors, protease and protease inhibitors in emphysema and parasites, drug design, and clinical diagnostics. He's founded several biotech companies, synthesized the first peptidyl fluoromethane, which I have no idea what that is, was a member of Thabo Mbeki's South African Presidential Advisory Panel, and invented date analysis, the first quantitative theory of biological change. Since 1996, he's researched the aneuploidy theory of cancer with Peter Duisberg. I interviewed him on this subject on The Infectious Myth, episode number 5. Or, if you want more details, you can read his book, Chromosomal Imbalance Theory of Cancer. He has a doctorate from Georgia Tech, the Georgia Institute of Technology, which involves the synthesis of protease inhibitors, and he has both a BS in chemistry and biology from the same place. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rasnick.
Hi, Dave. Can I call you Crow so that you, I, and the listeners won't get confused?
That's just fine. I'll have to call you Raz.
That's right. I think that'll work.
Okay, yeah, I'll Raz you as much as I can.
Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah. Well, you've done quite a bit of research in some of the more basic science of the whole Ebola thing, so that's what we're going to talk about today. And you were kind enough to share the list of documents that you had read with me. Right now in the news is the case of Martin Celia, a doctor from Sierra Leone who became somewhat ill, was diagnosed Ebola negative, didn't get better, tested positive, and was shipped in a rush to the U.S. where he died. He apparently didn't come in contact with an Ebola patient, and there's very little information about what the tests were that he took, how reliable they are, and what drugs, very importantly, what drugs he was given. I did see in one article that being a doctor, he self-medicated with malaria medication and possibly other things. And I heard on a radio show that he was given experimental immune therapy, ZMAP. His family said that he got, his family said that he should have got treated earlier, but what if the treatment was what killed him? I mean, there seems to be so much taken on faith in these articles. What's your thoughts, Raz, on
these? I've only seen that in the headlines when I look online about these things. As you know, I don't get terribly excited or worked up about these things because we've been through this time and time again with these fabricated epidemics going back at least into the 70s. Primarily, the CDC is generally the ones responsible for this. And as you pointed out, you know, people are dying all the time. I don't know how many millions of people die every year from whatever reason, and certainly out of Africa. But as soon as you start talking about hemorrhagic fever or Ebola or HIV or anything like that, whatever the context is that the person's death is part of the news item or whatever, it's like, well, everything else is just out the window. You forget that people can die of any number of things. And generally, one of the first questions I get when it doesn't matter which one of these infectious diseases you're talking about, but in this case it's Ebola, and then they say, but well, then if it's not Ebola, what's killing these people? You know?
Right. As if there was nothing else in Africa that could cause. Well, let's talk about it. You mentioned hemorrhagic fever, and can you describe what a true hemorrhagic fever is?
Well, I mean, I haven't looked into, probably not looked nearly as closely into the details about that, this whole hemorrhagic fever business as you have. I've been involved primarily as a consequence of correspondence with the investigative journalist John Rappaport, who basically drugged me kicking and screaming into this Ebola thing because I personally didn't have a whole lot of interest in it, but he's a good journalist. and he kept wanting to know what's going on, and he asked me very specific questions. He wanted to know had the Ebola virus ever been properly purified and isolated. And I took that.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Why don't we go? Right. Why don't we start there? That's a good starting point.
Okay. And I took that to mean from a human being, which is, he and I have had a series of email correspondences, and that's what he was talking about. So I went to literature. I already had a file on Ebola over the years, and because it's hot now, I went and started looking into this again for John Rappaport. He's not a scientist, and I am, so I felt it was my duty to help him out with this, because I can have access to the literature and I can read it fairly easily without worrying about the jargon and stuff like that. So
right.
I dug into it. I got those, looked at those papers back in the 70s. There was one by Bowen. About 77, there's at least three papers. Papen, if that's how you pronounce it, Johnson, Bowen, some others.
That's right.
And then before the Ebola stuff, and there's the Marburg virus. These are, let me see if I'm saying it right, filoviruses or whatever. It's these spindly little things that everybody has seen in the newspapers, on the TV, or the Internet. When I first saw those EM pictures, when I saw Peter Duisberg, I said, Peter, what are those things that we're looking at there that look like strings? I said, I'm not familiar with any virus that looks like a string like that, and it's sort of got knots in it and goes this way and goes that way. He said he wasn't sure what they were, because he doesn't have a whole lot of interest in this area either, because there's really not much to it, but we'll set that aside for now. And so I went and I looked up the literature on these things. It's very clear from what I've looked at and what you've looked at, mm-hmm. other people, these are original papers. They're very skimpy. They're very short little papers. They, from Africa, the samples that they get from human beings that have some sort of clinical problems, they send the samples in not very good condition to Europe and to the United States, the CDC, back in the 70s. And then they get these things, and then they infect green monkey cells with them to try to culture any virus that might be present. And then they make some pictures, EM pictures, and all the EM pictures of those papers that I just mentioned are really horrible. They're not convincing anything. So that doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem, because they were more or less the first papers. And then what you would expect if it was a real scientific project and conducted in a scientific manner, more capable people, scientists, would have taken the material, would have reproduced experiments, would have confirmed or disconfirmed the claims in these other papers. But that didn't happen. I can't find any evidence of anybody having isolated or obtained, if you want to use that word, this Ebola virus, or for that matter, the Marburg virus, from any human sample. You cannot directly. I mean, it's, apparently all the examples of these viruses come from green monkeys, and I'm wondering if that's even true.
Well, yeah, who knows? My understanding is that the first three papers, which you're basically implying that those first three papers stand on the record as the proof that a virus was isolated and shown to be the cause. Two of those three papers were worked on samples from a single individual.
Right.
So even if you found a virus in a single individual and proved that it killed that person, which is, you know, to me is actually a pretty difficult thing to do, even if you found that, that doesn't prove that tens or hundreds of other people with similar symptoms are all having those symptoms caused by the same virus. I mean, it kind of shocked me that they would, you know, draw these broad conclusions based on samples from a single individual.
Yeah, it's worse than that, because it's not clear at all that what they're showing or what they're talking about ever came from a human being to begin with. That's the first thing. The second thing is, is that there's no evidence whatever that these things that they claim, like Marburg virus and Ebola virus, actually cause any disease. I've been around a while. I know about these infectious agents. And anytime you have an infectious disease, they tend to be localized, especially if they're viruses, into particular tissues. And it's a general rule that about 30% of the cells that are infected have to be killed by the virus before you have any symptoms. And you find little pustules, or if you have whatever tissues infected with these viruses, you can take those samples, direct samples, and you can obtain directly from those tissues, whether it's blood, whether it's liver, pus, or from a wound or whatever, and there'll be millions of these viral particles right there easily, hundreds of millions, billions of particles right there.
Right.
That are causing pathology, and you can spot these things and treat them. If that were not true, then virology would never have existed before we have molecular biology, PCR, and all this other sorts of stuff.
Right. Well, you know, some of the things they did, like in the patent paper, which is the third of the 1977
right.
papers, they took
right.
a sample of serum from one person, a 42-year-old woman.
Right.
And they inoculated it into six mice by
right.
intracerebral and intraperitoneal. So
right.
intracerebral is directly into the brain, and intraperitoneal is into the abdominal cavity, right?
Right, that's right.
Okay, now it doesn't say, and then they also injected it into 2 liters of newborn mice intracerebrally. Okay,
right.
And then also into some cell cultures. Now, It bothers me how badly written these papers are, because it doesn't say whether some mice were injected into the brain and some into the abdomen, but it sounds in this case that they injected the mice directly into the brain and into the abdomen. And so if you take foreign blood serum and that has no virus and inject it into the brain of a mouse, it could still have consequences.
Yeah,
and even
right.
so, even so, only 2 of the 6 mice died, and who knows? I mean, the needle might not have been completely sterile. It might have pushed the needle in too far. I mean, there's 100 things that could have gone wrong that could have caused a mouse to die after you stick a needle in its head with foreign serum, in my
right.
opinion.
Right, exactly. So where are the control experiments?
Well, yes. Like, why didn't they take blood serum from somebody from Zaire who's perfectly healthy, and also inject that into exactly the same way into 6 mice, and then randomize the mice and, you know, make sure nobody knows which mouse has been injected with what,
right.
And then see what happens, because this is full of kind of speculation. I mean, the 2 mice that died, it assumes it's because they died of a virus, and then it did this cell culturing, and some of the cells came detached from the test tube, and then it said, well, we first thought this was a cytopathic effect of the virus. However, it did not increase, and so we thought it was nonspecific. So, I mean, it seemed like these guys were just taking the serum they had. They were so excited that they just injected it into whatever they had sitting in the lab, and what happens? Let's see what happens, and then we'll write a paper. This is really exciting.
That paper that you're talking about is not even full 2 pages long. It's only about like a page and a half. And it's the worst of the 3, and all 3 of them are horrible.
But you know what's really important about it is that one of the authors is Peter Piot.
Yeah, I know, the AIDS guy.
Yeah, that gives him street cred as one of the discoverers or inventors of the whole Ebola thing in the first place. We were talking about symptoms earlier, and there was a paper that I mentioned on my previous show that they studied, I think it was published around 2010, they studied 44, well, they studied a few more, but they found 44 patients in Gabon for which they had fairly complete medical records, and only 1 out of the 44 had any kind of bleeding, and it didn't say anything about how serious that was. But hemorrhagic fever, from what I've read, is basically blood and blood-contaminated materials, like blood mixed with feces and other things, coming out of every orifice. I mean, it sounds like it's a horrible thing, and it's the kind of thing
right.
that if you saw in a movie, you'd be totally grossed out. It's a really horrible death, But as far as I can tell, there's no mention of anybody in this recent epidemic having hemorrhagic symptoms. And the definitions don't require that.
Yeah, I know. I remember back in the 70s, I was in graduate school, either finishing undergraduate or in graduate school. I can't remember which, but I remember the first time, it was back in those days, it was the first time I heard about these hemorrhagic fevers. And boy, they really were frightening. But thank goodness in Africa, you know, you get this virus and then you start bleeding from everywhere. I was young enough in those days not to be terribly skeptical.
Here's the current, this is, you sent this to me. This is the CDC's case definition for Ebola virus disease. And so a person under investigation, which is, I guess, sometimes called a possible or probable case. They only have two categories. The person under investigation, a person who has both consistent signs or symptoms and risk factors as follows. So number one is elevated body temperature or subjective fever symptoms, including severe headaches, fatigue, muscle pain, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, or unexplained hemorrhage.
Guess what that sounds like? I've lived in Africa, I've lived in Papua New Guinea, places where they have lots of malaria. Those are the exact symptoms of malaria, except for the bleeding all over.
And the second thing is an epidemiological risk factor within the 21 days before the onset of symptoms, and that usually means that you've been in an Ebola epidemic area, an area that's been declared to be an Ebola epidemic area, or you've directly treated or been in contact with someone with Ebola. And so this second part of the definition actually makes it seem like it's an infectious disease because only people who've been in contact can qualify for a diagnosis.
Yes, another one of these artifacts of definition.
Right. And then the second thing, for a confirmed case, you need those two things. And again, these are so badly written. Like let me read the first category. So a person under investigation has to have two things. The second is the epidemiological risk factor. That's very simple and clear. The first one is, and I'm reading this precisely as written, elevated body temperature or subjective fever or symptoms, comma, including severe headache, fatigue, muscle pain, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, or unexplained hemorrhage. So I'm not sure how many of those things you need to have in order to qualify for step number one.
Right.
Do you understand?
I know exactly what you're saying. It's like any of those. It could be any of those things.
Yeah, I mean, if I have a fever, is that enough for me to be a person under investigation? If my wife was diagnosed with Ebola, or I'm a nurse at the hospital, is that all it takes? Is a fever? That's what it sounds like.
Well, basically, all it takes is somebody says you're an Ebola patient. That's all it takes.
Right. Now, for a confirmed case, you need laboratory-confirmed diagnostic evidence of Ebola virus infection. But you sent me several papers, and I'll read the level of positivity of Ebola tests in places that did not have a current Ebola epidemic. In Gonzalez, 1989, 12.4% of randomly selected people in six African countries tested positive on the Ebola test. In Johnson in 1993 had two papers. The first one in the Central African Republic found that 17.6% tested positive for Ebola, 1.2% for Marburg. The second paper was actually quite similar, 21.3% for Ebola, 3.2% in Marburg, and they noted that wetter areas seemed to have much higher levels. So in some places it was getting up close to 50%. Gonzalez in 2000 in the Central African Republic found 5% were positive for Ebola, 2.4% for Marburg, and amongst pygmy women, 15%. So this seems to me to show that if you ran around Africa testing people just randomly, you would get a pretty significant number of people testing positive.
Yep. Huge numbers when you consider there's roughly a billion people in Africa. So,
like we could be talking conservatively 100 million people easily would test positive on the Ebola antibody test. Well, now they seem to be using the PCR tests, but I have seen no evidence that the PCR test has been tested, like the antibody tests, on the general population. And PCR
yeah,
is known.
I haven't seen that either.
Yeah, and PCR is known to have a problem with false positives because it's so sensitive.
That's right.
So quite likely has a similar issue. So if 10 nurses are exposed to an Ebola patient and 10 nurses get a fever and two or three or four of those test positive on an Ebola test, does that mean they're infected or does that mean it's just a normal false positive rate?
Well, you and I know the answer to that. We know nothing about these tests. We don't know how they were developed, what their levels of accuracy are. They just popped up here all of a sudden overnight, basically, because there was really no, prior to just some months ago, there was no Ebola epidemic or anything in the news. So these things are just popping up overnight. And now they're having these companies, these little biotech companies, coming up with various Ebola therapies. They're taking advantage of the opportunity that's a hot area right now, and you better get in on it before it disappears.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the epidemic took enough press time that no politician is going to argue against funding Ebola research. Although, and here's another reason, one of the papers you sent me, Leroy, 2011, seemed quite scathing about the importance of filoviruses. It said, since their discovery 50 years ago, filoviruses have caused only a few outbreaks with just over 2,000 clinical cases and 1,671 confirmed deaths, which is negligible compared with the devastation caused by malnutrition and other infectious diseases prevalent in Africa. Yet, considerable human and financial resources have been devoted to research on these viruses during the past two decades, partly because of their potential use as bioweapons. Which
yeah,
I found a
I
pretty
know.
Shocking
yeah.
statement.
It's very shocking. That's a very recent one, too.
Is it that governments don't really want to do germ warfare research openly, but if we study Ebola, even though it's maybe not really too important in the grand scheme of things, but it's probably one of the big candidates for a bioweapon, that we can do all this research?
I doubt it, because if there was any evidence at all, which there is none, there's no evidence at all that this thing they call Ebola or Marburg is pathogenic anyway. I can't find
right.
it. Where is the evidence, even if it exists, where is the evidence that it causes harm? It's not there.
Right. Well, it's actually
a very poor biological weapon.
Yeah. It was really interesting reading those papers on the rate of people testing positive, because they, of course, didn't say that the reason why 17, 21, 12% of people test positive for Ebola is because the tests are lousy. They said that what it means is that there's a huge number of people who are getting Ebola and not getting sick.
Yeah, that's
right. But then when there's an epidemic,
yeah,
it's like every 50% of the people who get Ebola are dying. So how can this be?
Okay, now let's answer that question, try to answer it in a different direction. Where is this
okay.
epidemic happening? West Central Africa.
Right.
You know? And what's so particular, you and I have talked about this before, so what could be the other possibilities of why there is this interest and this hype in that part of the world? It certainly has nothing to do with the health of Africans. If that were true, they would talk about malaria and TB and malnutrition and other things.
Well, they might talk about the impact of the Western countries exploiting the African nations for their mineral resources without building any infrastructure and exploiting the dictatorships to try to keep the people from complaining about pollution from exploitation and things like that. But no, they don't want to talk about that. But there is a lot of oil in West Africa. There's a lot of mineral resources. And it's pretty clear that the U.S. military wants to have a big base in Africa. And Liberia would be a really good place to do that.
Well, one of Obama's first responses to this Ebola thing was to send, 5,000 troops there, Marines or soldiers or whatever it was. And I thought that's a very interesting thing to do in an infectious plague, to send these soldiers.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was kind of thinking to myself, like, what are these soldiers going to do? I mean, I understand that there is, you know, amongst soldiers, there's a lot of engineers, and they can build clinics or whatever. But, I mean, if you don't have the doctors on the ground, you know, the local doctors to staff the clinics, and if you don't have a government that has a functioning health ministry that can actually manage these institutions. I mean, they're just going to be concrete buildings that, you know, 1 year from now, there's going to be plants growing in them because nobody's paying the doctors and nurses anymore.
Now, it has nothing to do with health. I'm convinced of that. Liberia has a lot of political turmoil. In fact, all of Western Africa, at least most of it, the Congo, Nigeria, Liberia, I mean, those places have serious political problems there. Uprisings, the people are estranged from the government. There's a disconnect there, certainly in Liberia.
Right.
And in fact, the BBC actually let loose a month or so ago a program where they had investigative journalists in Liberia, and they had these compounds where the citizens were put inside these wired compounds ostensibly to be quarantined. But then
right.
The journalists started asking the people. They weren't sick. They were pretty healthy. And they asked these people, and they said, no, there's nobody sick around here. You know, they're just basically putting them in jail and calling it a quarantine.
There was no
follow-up stories, unfortunately, after that one. I was hoping that there would be some more follow-up stories. Now, I lived in South Africa for 15
right.
months, and we have Helen Lauer. She's there in West Africa. And I've personally seen the difference between the reality of what goes on, in particular in South Africa, and what the New York Times and the Western press say about that same situation in the United States, and you would not know they were talking about the same story. Completely different. I don't trust anything in the Western press that comes from Africa. It's just totally unreliable, a pack of lies, invented. But it certainly has nothing to do with what is really actually going on in Africa.
Well, usually my rule about the press is that if you know anything about the story, you realize that what you're reading is total junk. I mean, I started to realize that when I started to work in the field of telecom, and I'd read articles in the general press, and I'd realize they just don't understand this at all. And it's definitely true of medicine. If you start to learn about a particular area, you realize there's huge questions that they have left unopened.
But it's done its job. If the hype has done its job. It's really pumped up fear. Governments tend to use fear a lot, like whether it was 9/11 and terrorism, or a constant state of fear seems to be essential, or just the everyday sort of thing that certainly the government of the United States is involved in. It's constantly keeping either a low grade or medium grade level of fear in society. And at some point, I wonder if it's going to be like Chicken Little, and maybe it's already there. It certainly is true with me. I don't pay attention to any of it. I know it's a pile of crap, and it's invented and lies, outright lies. And I have a feeling that there's probably a growing number of people that realize the same thing. But still, it served its purpose, whatever that purpose is.
The noise, the noise from the mainstream media, from politicians, from healthcare professionals is so great that there's very little room for people to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, like, what are you talking about? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, you were talking about your experiences in Africa. I also talked to Professor Helen Lauer, who's at the University of Ghana in Accra, about the whole Ebola thing. And, you know, to her it seemed like a virtual epidemic because she sees the, the daily problems in Africa, like malaria and tuberculosis and malnutrition, that these are constants in Africa. There's people dying because they don't have enough to eat, because they're drinking contaminated water, because they don't have basic health care, so they get a wound, it gets infected, and they die. Those are the kinds of things that people are dying from. And, you know, a few people die, and the West is worried about it because they think that it's going to cross the oceans and cause a massive epidemic in America or Europe. And then all of a sudden, everybody in Africa is supposed to be really excited about what the West is worried about.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, Yeah, I mean, it's the opposite. Like, we in the West think of it, well, I shouldn't say we, because I opt out of this whole thing, but the mainstream press is pushing this idea that if you care about the Africa, if you care about people in Africa, you want to be charitable, you should help out with this Ebola thing. But it's like looking at the grand scheme of things, even if we totally eliminated Ebola from Africa, that would have a negligible impact on the death rate in Africa.
Probably zero.
Even if it's got anything to do with it. Yeah. One of the things you highlighted in your in the papers that you read was that there was some mention of other factors, like in two papers actually from the CDC. I don't know if it was the Central African Republic or some other country. They noted that it was very difficult to get to various places where this epidemic was supposedly happening because there was a civil war going on.
Right, exactly.
In a couple of papers from 2004, they mentioned connections with gold mining.
Right.
And in another paper in 1998, they mentioned that the epidemic started in people working at a cotton factory.
Right.
Now, there's never any discussion of what are the environmental factors. Like in a civil war, you have exacerbated malnutrition. You may have exposure to toxic chemicals from weapons, things like that.
Right.
Gold mining,
it's
similar.
Toxic anyway. Yeah, it's very, what they use, the chemicals they use to extract the gold are very poisonous.
Right, and sometimes when you dig up minerals from the ground, that releases toxic metals that are found along with the gold. So there appeared to be no interest in that. But in one paper I read, there was like somebody found a dead chimpanzee in the forest, and they cut it up and ate it. And so, oh, that could be the source of the epidemic. They got all excited over the dead chimpanzee.
Right.
Absolutely no interest in environmental factors.
Yeah. Let me tell you what got me interested in that business about the Civil War and that gold mine business was, see, I'm a chemist, and I know about the toxic chemicals that they use, very poisonous stuff. It has to be very, very well controlled. They didn't have any health problems in the mine before the area was involved in this Civil War. It was only after the mine was closed. And some people went back to it, you know, after the mine was closed. And then they started mining the gold anyway to generate money to either live with or to pay for the Civil War. And that is only at that point that they start finding these problems, these people being sick. After it, you see, when it wasn't regulated. And I looked and studied because the first thing I was trying to do is I sort of had a suspicion that it was probably these chemicals involved in the mine, the poisons there, as you pointed out, the minerals and the chemicals that they use to extract gold and these other metals from the mine. And then the fact that it happened after these people took back over the mine, then I said, aha, that's consistent with toxicity because these people don't really know what they're doing. They just want to go in there and get the gold out and sell it and make the money. And when I was looking at this even more and more, it was so funny. They tried these Westerners were looking all around. They were looking around, not just at the mine itself, but in the vicinity of the mine, and they couldn't find anything. Couldn't find any disease. Couldn't find any Ebola, anything like that.
Right.
But then
they go down,
and they said the only place it existed was inside the mine itself. And
right.
Then
I felt
that
they were looking
that the virus was in the mine.
Right.
in the batch.
Right. I was thinking that this was, it kind of reminded me of Lord of the Rings or something, that, you know, there's some evil animal lurking underground, and if you go mining gold, it might bite you, and then you get Ebola. That sort of seemed to be where they were going. But that's actually an interesting, another interesting factor we need to talk about, is what's the natural reservoir for this? Like, some of the papers, basically, they said that they don't know.
That's right.
A paper from 2005, we don't know what the natural reservoir is.
Right.
Feldman in 2004 called it elusive, and in 2011 said no potential hosts have been identified. A Russian said it was unknown.
Right. Just like
I've heard talk of fruit bats,
which
seems a bit incredible, because I don't imagine fruit bats, which eat fruit, bite people too often.
No, they're totally harmless.
Right. Like, you know, maybe they mistake humans for apples or something. I don't know. And I think fruit bats probably like...
Well, I mean, you can't take any of this stuff seriously. You know, I bring it up just to point out how absurd it is. You know, but there's no science here. If there was any science here at all, there would be skepticism. There would be alternative hypotheses. There would be juggling this and juggling that, you know. But there's no science at all involved in any of this stuff. It's a charade. It's a sham.
But for the mainstream theory, it's a big hole that they don't have a natural reservoir, because this is not a disease that's supposed to be around all the time. It comes and goes. And so that says that if it is an infectious disease, it has to have a natural host, because, I mean, a virus can't sort of sit there for 5 years and then pop out of the ground and infect somebody. It's got to be in a living host that whole time. And so the fact that they found no plausible living hosts all this time is a big problem, which never gets mentioned in the mainstream media. It's like,
well, I'm not surprised. I mean, they don't care. They don't care. They don't. The mainstream people do not look into details. There's no skepticism there.
Right, because it's scientists who are supposed to be the skeptics. But, of course, the scientists are in on this.
And journalists, too. Journalists should be, too.
Well,
they
should be,
yes. Investigative journalists, you know, and they don't really exist much anymore.
Well, when it comes to science, I think that journalists are supposed to just accept the wisdom that comes from the scientists, just like 200 years ago they were supposed to accept the wisdom that came from the mouth of a priest or a bishop or a pope or something like that. And now, of course, you know, journalists can be very skeptical when the pope says something, but when Peter Piot says something, it can be the most ridiculous thing, and they just write it down and take it seriously. And then if they can't understand it, they figure that's because they're not smart enough.
Well, I think it's worse than that. I don't think there's any skepticism, no professional skepticism in journalism. If they are skeptics, they keep it to themselves, or it's edited out before it ever gets on air or in print. It's just not there.
Yes.
I've met a number over the years, interviewed with lots of journalists, and I actually like the journalists, and they ask good questions and things, by and large. There's some that are totally hopeless. But then almost always the article or the video or whatever never went anywhere. It was never published or never aired, and it wasn't the journalist's fault. You know, they have...
Well, I agree. I think I've been contacted several times from journalists on the subject of AIDS or something like that, and they talk to me, and I'm thinking to myself, do you understand what's going to happen when you write this article, that when it gets to your editor? But of course, I don't say anything because I don't want to discourage them, and the article never appears, and I never hear back from the journalist, and if I write to the journalist again, they stop responding.
Right.
And I'm sure that they get their knuckles wrapped by the editor, who says, do you know what the CDC is going to do to us if you publish this? You know, something saying that a disease model is false, or is a problem with vaccination, or something like that, they're going to go crazy. And then, you know, who do we talk to when we have a story? We talk to the CDC, and they won't call us back. We have to keep on their good side.
Yeah, but, you know, there's other people that talk to them. You would talk to them. I'd talk to them. Peter Duesberg would talk to them. So it's not that there aren't people that will talk to them. It's just not the right people.
Right, but it's very effective, I think, for the mainstream to say, well, you need to get both sides of this. You can't go talking to people like that without getting the other side. And then the other side tries to push you into not talking about the critic's side, or the other side refuses to talk to you, in which case you can say, well, you don't have both sides, so you can't publish it. I think there's lots of techniques to suppress critical thinking in medicine.
Well, institutional society, I mean journalism, science, everything, all institutional society in the United States is co-opted now. I'm afraid there are very, very few institutions that are reliable or trustworthy. There may be some examples that are, but right off the top of my head, I can't think of them.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like this business of co-opting organizations. I mean, it's just like with the AIDS epidemic, how the organization of the gay community was used to push drugs and testing into the gay community.
Still is.
And still is. And made a few gay men very rich, and made a lot of gay men very dead. But that was, never really, nobody was ever able to counteract that to any considerable degree, and AIDS is still embedded into the gay psyche. It's very sad.
Yeah, I don't see the Ebola stuff doing this. I just can't see it catching on in the U.S. and Europe. I think it's a short-term fear thing. So, like, sorry.
Right, but it's going to generate huge. It's going to generate huge budgets. Like CDC and World Health Organization, they're probably going to pull in hundreds of millions of dollars for research, this, that, and the other thing.
They will.
That's what this is all about, I think, is the CDC's budget, the World Health Organization's budget. GlaxoSmithKline will be happy because now they can test their vaccine, and because it's an epidemic, they've reduced the ethical standards. Plus, they've reduced the scientific standards of the testing because it's such a rush. They'll put it in a bunch of people. They'll measure some antibodies and say, oh, goody, they've got antibodies against Ebola, and they'll assume that that gives them protection against this virus.
You're absolutely right. That will happen. My feeling is, though, since the U.S. federal government, including at the level of the executive branch and Obama, and then sending those troops there, I think that there's a bigger political reason. I don't claim to know what that is. I think it has a lot to do with American presence, physical military presence on the western part of Africa, and in that area that happens to be very resource-rich and lots of oil there. I think that that probably is the primary reason. I'm guessing, but I think it's a reasonable guess, certainly based on the history of how these things happen. We certainly don't care very much, never have very much, about the Middle East except for oil. What else is there to care about from the U.S. perspective? Care about Western Africa?
Yeah, the Chinese have been very successful in Africa. They move in, they build a road, they build a mine, they extract resources, and they don't seem to care about overthrowing the government. But, you know, when the first thing the U.S. seems to have to do is to make sure that there's a compliant government in place.
That's right.
And soldiers, they seem to care more about the military aspect than the economic aspect, which is a bit strange.
I think.
I don't understand that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the testing. You sent me a document from the CDC which talked about the different kinds of tests that should be done, and they categorized them as the tests within a few days of symptoms, the tests later in disease or in recovery, and postmortem tests. And so the first tests were supposed to be antigen capture ELISA, IgM ELISA, PCR, or virus isolation.
I see this, what you're talking about now.
So can you explain the difference between antigen capture and IgM ELISA?
Yeah, the antigen capture, if it's what I'm familiar with back in the days when I was involved with this stuff at Abbott Laboratories, it's any of the viral antigens that are in the person, and you provide antibodies that will capture those antibodies, you know, bind with those antibodies. You know, it's like with P24 with HIV. I think it was P21 or something like that. All right. The IgM, ELISA, that's IgM is like, like when you have an allergy, I believe it's IgM.
Right.
And that's probably a skin ELISA test. And ELISA just stands for enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay.
For an ELISA, you put a sample on a treated piece of paper or some other substrate, and the substrate is chemically treated so that it changes color if binding occurs.
Yeah, exactly. You bind it, and it sticks to something. You wash everything else away that's not bound, for example,
right,
and then you can either throw in a substrate or another antibody that binds to the antibody complex. I mean, that's all a bunch of ways they do it see if there is a reaction.
It's not a positive negative test. It is a color change, and so there's a continuum. And with these tests, they arbitrarily choose.
Right.
They arbitrarily choose a particular density and say below this is negative, above this is positive.
Right. AIDS started this whole thing with HIV, where it set a precedent where you can get away with anything. You can literally get away with murder. And these tests presume that these antibodies are specific. Now, the antibodies that the human produces, are they have the spectrum of antibodies. They're nonspecific, and it's this nonspecific immune response that we have. That's why we're not sick all the time. They can react with infectious agents as long as they're not highly concentrated and bind to them well enough to remove them from the make sure they don't do anything. Then you have the so-called monoclonal antibodies that are produced in the laboratory, and they are pretty specific. And they will bind some antigens, but there's no such thing as a totally specific antibody. And you don't really know what you're measuring unless you have some sort of control.
The antigens are the proteins from the virus, right?
Right. The antigens.
Where did those come from if they haven't purified the virus?
Well, they probably synthesize them, you know.
But how do you synthesize proteins if you don't have pure virus to start with? How do you know?
You get the let's start back from what you mean by pure virus. You can have pure virus that has nothing to do from the source. For example, one of these references that I sent you was this Ryabchikova, 2004, Russian. It's just, I went and saw the book, but the only thing I could get online was the CDC book review about this.
Right.
And it's some of the best EM pictures. I mean, they're really, really spectacular, high-quality EM pictures that convinced me that these little squiggly things that were supposedly Ebola and Marburg and all that, that those things are real. They're real in the sense that they can culture them, they can generate them over and over again, they can inject animals with these things, high concentrations of these things, they can see them in the animals' tissues, and they get really, really good pictures. So that thing that they call Ebola is real. Now, that's a completely separate issue from saying, does this thing actually exist in human beings? That's, first of all, that's one thing. And the second thing is, does this thing cause disease and pathology? And certainly it really care about in nature, not in the laboratory where you can do anything in the laboratory, basically. Ryabchikova book.
This is called The Russian Paper.
The Russian, it's actually a book. And it's a very, very good book. And the laboratory and the work was done in Siberia. And let me tell you where they got their viruses from. They got them from the Russian military. They say that at the beginning of the book, but they don't say anything about, where the Russian military.
Bioweapon thing. I don't imagine that the Russian military had them for any reason except they wanted to play around with them. And they probably knew that this Russian was really good with the electron microscope, so they wanted to see.
Well, historically, I think people do, whenever there's a little bit of hype about a new virus, and the Russians have certainly done this in the past. They did it with HIV, for example, and they thought, ha-ha, this might be a good weapon. But they couldn't turn it into a weapon. They couldn't make it pathogenic.
Right.
And my guess is the Ebola thing is probably something similar, that they say, here's a good prospect, and so they worked with it, and they did all these cultures with the green monkeys and everything, and they got all these marvelous samples of Ebola virus that are totally irrelevant.
Well, it is you may be correct that it is possible to purify the virus for an electron microscope, but I suspect that when they produced the ELISA tests, they produced cell cultures, and then they used centrifugation to separate the proteins by weight. And then without further ado, declared that this density is the antigen, and we're going to build that into the ELISA. And if it reacts with most people who we think had Ebola, then it's accurate. And let's not test it too much on the general population, because we know that 25% of the general population is also going to test positive.
Okay, that's the antigen. Now, if you have this antigen, you know, this Ebola antigen, and that, and then you react it with the person's blood to see if there's, there's antibodies in that blood. That's a very, very different story than if you have antibodies against the antigen that the antigen is supposed to be in the person. The non-specificity of human antibodies, I mean, you'll always, depending on the concentration, you'll always get antibody-antigen reaction.
A matter of the strength.
Just a matter of strength, and that's where we come back to. It's not an all or none, on or off. It's like, is it intense, and how intense, 20% relative to what, 100%?
I saw an article by somebody, I think from the Centers for Disease Control, and it involved testing people for Ebola, and it seemed like it was PCR testing. So I wrote to him and said, you know, which PCR test were you using, and where has it been validated against the general population? And guess what happened?
No response.
How did you guess?
Well, I've not gotten any. I asked when I was digging up this information for John Rappaport, I searched the CDC's website for information, and they also had a little place there where you could ask questions about this Ebola, because it's really hot. So I asked them, what were the criteria, you know, of isolating Ebola, and also I wanted to know what the protocol was. And haven't heard anything back about that. And I didn't expect to, other than possibly a general thing, and they refer you to another website or whatever like that. But not, total silence on that. So I'm not surprised.
Yes. Well, this paper was in the MMWR, which people in the know is the Centers for Disease Control weekly newsletter. It had a bunch of African names on it, and this is typical. As you go further down the list, the names get less and less African, and the last guy's name is Frank Mahoney, and he's the corresponding author. So you know that he was...
He probably wrote the paper,
right? And he's Frank Mahoney at cdc.gov. So I wrote to him, and this is what I wrote. Dear Frank, I am interested in how the RT, which I think stands for real-time or reverse transcriptase, PCR test for Ebola was validated as accurate for detection of Ebola, and how the false positive, false negative rates were calculated. Do you have references to scientific papers providing this information for the specific test or tests used in the current outbreak in Liberia and elsewhere? So I think that wasn't too insulting of a letter. I think it was pretty clear what I wanted.
Yeah,
I got nothing.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. But, you know, I have a feeling that I think the CDC screens things. They probably flag anything from Peter Duisberg, from your name, from my name, from a lot of people, and just automatically don't respond. That's why I encourage other people to ask them questions, people who've never really contacted the CDC or any place like that. To do it, because I think basically we're flagged.
Right. Well, maybe somebody should give him a call. His phone number is in the MMWR article, and somebody could phone him and ask him, where's the information validating his test? I mean, my fear is that the PCR test was developed within the CDC.
Probably.
And that it's been very shoddily reviewed for false positive, false negative. It was done in a hurry. It is not really necessarily a commercial test. It doesn't really say.
Probably had it gone through the FDA.
Yes. And so nobody really knows the accuracy, but it serves the purpose of pumping up fear. And if they want to change things, they could simply change the testing that they were doing. And if they went to a test that had a lot lower false positive rate, then all of a sudden everybody would be testing negative, and they could say, well, it looks like we got the epidemic under control.
Yeah, I mean, that's conceivable. The thing is that I don't think these people, they're calculating, but I don't think they're that calculating. I think it's like, well, the calculation comes in initiating all this mess and then walking away from it and let it have a life of its own. And they periodically, if they want to keep it going like they did with AIDS, they just keep pumping it up and pumping it up periodically and putting lots of billions of dollars in it. Otherwise, if it's a short-term goal, they just get it going, leave it alone, let it disappear.
Right. I think what happened with Ebola at the beginning is looking at the press from a mainstream point of view, the CDC seemed a little bit out of control, that they'd overhyped it, and they were trying to say, "Oh, don't worry about it. It's not transmitted by droplets and this kind of stuff."
I got the impression they were trying to pull it back a little.
Yeah, and it seemed like the CDC was a little bit out of control, and this had the potential to bring the CDC down with it, because if they made statements and all of a sudden there's 1,000 people in America testing positive for Ebola, I mean, the CDC would just be being put out of business.
They're totally safe. They're totally safe. Nobody's going to call them on it. Journalists aren't going to call them on it. Who's going to call them on it?
Yeah, well, obviously not the journalists we're reading, because, you know, they're completely, they have no skepticism at all about these pronouncements that are made. They have no interest in knowing what the tests are. They have no interest in knowing specifically what the symptoms are. They have no interest in knowing if the drugs that are being given are have any side effects. I mean, one of the first things they should do with this doctor from Sierra Leone is to find out all the drugs that he medicated himself with before he got on the plane, and then all the drugs he was given while he was on the plane, and what are the known side effects of those drugs, and are any of those side effects things that he was suffering from?
Of course, because that's the obvious thing to do. It won't happen.
Yes, and yes,
I think you're hoping for more logic and rationality than is there. The CDC, it's a political organization. It's not a health organization. Same thing with the FDA, pharmaceutical industry. They're money machines. They're not about health.
They're all scratching each other's back. Like GlaxoSmithKline knows very well, if they can get WHO all excited about some new infectious disease, that it's money for them. There's going to be a vaccine program, or there's going to be a new drug or something. And then the World Health Organization says, well, gee, if we get everybody all excited about Ebola, then next year we can come back in our budget and we say, well, you know, we can't take Ebola funding out of our existing budget. We have to add another X millions of dollars. And the CDC's got to say, our duty as Americans to help save lives in Africa. So we need $100 million for our Ebola campaign. And National Institutes of Health, well, they'll probably want $1 billion for research into Ebola. We've got to sequence the genome. We've got to find better tests. We've got to find better medications, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's a feeding frenzy for everybody. Anyway, I hear the music, which is telling me that we got to go. So,
okay. Tell people they can look at my website and they can see John Rappaport's blog, interview with him, and the Ebola files. They can download it. It's davidrasnick.com.
Okay. Thanks so much, Dr. Rasnick. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay, Crow. Thanks. Bye.